already feel a lot of affection for you. More. Part of it is environmental. I'm in love with this 60s arc. It's like my favorite period architecturally. Kent looks like Negan from The Walking Dead. I just can't stop thinking about it. And then, I don't know, I'm realizing there's black German Baptists. I didn't know that was a thing. So I'm proud. Excited about that. Your executive director cusses. I'm excited about that. Your worship leaders carry sticks of dynamite. I know, so much good going on here. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that if we had some hours together, I could almost certainly spend all of that time saying things that we would agree on. That if that was our intent, that we could look at the scriptures together, that we could pray together, that we could become fast friends, and we would walk away from this day thinking, you know that Brian Sanders, he's got his head on right, you know. But there's probably also a few things that I could say or bring to the discussion which would provoke you, which you may not completely agree with or have fully integrated. And that's what I want to do. So I'm asking for your permission to do that, because I recognize it's a lot to ask when you don't know a person. I'm asking for trust, for rapport, for openness, for you to let down your guard a little bit, to not feel threatened by anything I would say or ideas. If we can agree to those terms for the next few minutes and for the next several hours, I just think there's more for you to gain in that way. Of course, you can take it or leave it. You know, there's no power dynamic here. So the beauty is, we can be brave in the next few hours. I see a couple head nods, but I'm going to need a little more nonverbals from you. Can that be the terms? So you're gonna assume that I'm Orthodox. I'm not a heretic. All that stuff. I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to unpack theology. We can do that. But I just feel like we would already be on the same page there. So I'm going to push you more culturally. I'm going to essentially do forecasting, super forecasting, try to predict the future. And you know, that's a dodgy business. I may be wrong. Actually, I may be wrong in my suppositions. I may be wrong in my forecasting. So I'm open to that. I'm totally fine with that. I'm not trying to press a model or even particularly a point of view. I want to open you up, and I want to provoke you. Is that okay? Yep. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I love you.
Permission granted.
Thank you, my friend. I already love you. So love me back a little bit. deal? All right. I think it was 19. Okay, so let me give you a framework. So what we'll do is, I'll try to paint a picture in this first session of what I think the shape that the future church is going to take. It is currently taking. The underground would be like phenomenologically an example of sort of a native, a church form which is native and free. So that is to say, it's an example of what the church might look like if it had no strings attached, if it had no denominational expectations, if it just sort of emerged in a time. And so whether it's right or wrong, that's up to you to decide, to parse that out. But it exists, and it is from this time. So for no other reason, it's worthy of examination for that reason. And I, too, want to be sort of objective and step back and examine it, and not feel too connected to any one idea or any one operating principle. But having said that, I want to first talk about the shape the church is taking in our time. And I think that's sort of three forms. And the bad news is, the three forms that the church is emerging into and taking in our time is not what we're currently doing. So we're going to talk about that. And then what naturally flows out of that discussion, that ecclesiological discussion, is, okay, well then, what do I do? Because I'm not equipped or prepared to lead that form of church. The seminary didn't train me to do that. My current experience, my 10, 15, 20 years of church leadership experience has not prepared me to lead in that context, in that environment. So we're going to take the next session and talk about that. What are the new competencies that would be required? So if I'm right about the first part, then what would the new sort of leadership expectations be for you, for us, in this new milieu? And then finally, I want to talk about eschatology as innovation. That is to say, we need to look forward, way forward, like as far forward as we possibly can. And of course, as Christians, as believers, we can go all the way to the end of the story, to the end of time itself, to discover what it is that God is forming in us. And that, I think, that can make us brave in the choices and risks and things we have to do to move forward. So that'll be the third bit. And then, as Kent said, there's plenty of time, I think, worked into the schedule for you to come back at me. So if you have a question or frustration or a counterpoint, just write it down. And if it's really pressing, just say something. Feel free to, I mean, we can dialogue here, so just feel free to interrupt or whatever. And I'll be happy to say, can I come back to that or whatever. So don't hold back. Just be yourself. Sound good? All sound good? I think it was 1954 that a mid-distance runner, a guy called Roger Bannister. Anyone ever heard of Roger Bannister? Yeah, British guy. Oh, okay.
Yep.
He was. I think he was a neurologist. Is what he was. He was also a mid-distance runner. I think he may have placed in the 1952 Olympics or something. But there was this belief that you could not, that it was, the human body could not pierce the 4-minute mile. Like, no one had ever done it. And so it became this kind of invisible barrier. Like, it cannot be done. Physiologically, the human body could not run fast enough to break a 4-minute mile. It was just believed. And Bannister thought, you know, maybe that's not true. And so he kept trying to break this. And I think it was 1954. That he finally broke, I don't know, it was like 3:59.4 or something like that. And when he crossed the finish line of that mile, having broken the record, he collapsed. So he physically collapsed. And he thought, this is his own reporting, he thought he had died. Mm. He thought he killed himself. Now, I think that's just fascinating. Of course, what's interesting is that he held that record for 46 days. And people just started breaking it left and right. All of a sudden, that invisible barrier was broken. And it just wasn't holding back human achievement, I guess, anymore. I just think that's, like, sociologically incredible. What did he do, really? What does it mean to have these sort of invisible psychological barriers that are false, that are delusions, you know? This is me. That's embarrassing.
Just
what a loser. Silence your phone. Come on, guys. Jeez.
Just answer.
Yeah, no. That's worse.
It's God.
No, I don't think so. Anyway, there's always these invisible walls that hold us back. And there's some work that has to be done to admit that we have them, that we've made them up, that they're not real. And we need to probably give them a second thought. I mean, in the early church, which I'm definitely a primitive ecclesiology guy. I like to look to the first church for inspiration, for direction, but they had problems, didn't they? The early church had problems, and they had these same barriers. You know, there was the issue of, like, could the people of God really eat ceremonially, ritually unclean foods. Can we really do that? You know, now that sounds really ridiculous. Why would that be something that holds back the growth of the church? But it was. Could men who were not circumcised really be part of the kingdom of God? That was a real problem. Do you understand? It's laughable from our point of view, but there was a serious barrier. It felt like life and death, like the threshold of life and death, theologically, spiritually, whatever, emotionally for people. And it was serious controversy around those things. What are those things for us? You know, what are the things that we have made sacred which simply are not? I would say 80% of the way that we do church is not rooted in our biblical convictions or even our experiential discipleship in our actual living relationships with God. It's just cultural. I just made that number up, but I like it. 80% of the way we do church, the vast majority of the way we do church is simply a cultural expression of a deeper value. And so therefore, it's not sacred. It can be looked at. And in some cases, because the world is changing around us, because the Spirit of God is leading us into something else, if they become invisible walls, invisible barriers that keep us from being the people we're supposed to be and from actually executing the version or form of church which is desired by God in our time. We have to admit that. We have to repent, actually, for giving too much credence or respect to those invisible barriers. And all it takes is for someone to break through that barrier, and suddenly for the rest of us, it's okay. There's permission. It opens us up. It's what innovative specialist Stephen Johnson calls the adjacent possible. Once this is done, all of a sudden these other things are now open to us. So you need to be brave, and we need to do, I think, maybe even this morning, the hard work of ecclesiology. So anyway, we're gonna. I think we can step past some of these visible barriers, and you're not gonna die. This is the good news. You're not gonna die. You might collapse. You might think you're dying, but you're not gonna die. So let's take these three new forms. The first that I want to talk about is the microchurch. This, what I mean by this, is not just small groups or house churches or I do mean a decentralized smaller version of church, but I mean giving the church back to its people. Giving the church back to its people. To reduce the church to something which is usable by its common unit, the disciple, not the clergy person, not the paid professional, but the committed disciple of Jesus, to give the church back, essentially, to those people. So this is what I mean when I'm talking about micro churches. You remember the story of the Trojan horse, you know. I think it's in the Aeneid, Homer's Aeneid. That's its sort of canonical reference. The Greeks are laying siege to this impenetrable city of Troy. The walls are too high. The city cannot be breached. And for 10 years, they camp out and try to breach the walls of the Trojan city. And if you remember how the story goes, they finally decide in this sort of act of subterfuge, and they build this wooden horse, this massive wooden horse, and then they appear to retreat, and so they sail away into the night. But Odysseus and others have sort of snuck into this wooden horse, and the Trojans, thinking they have now finally defeated the Greeks, won this war of attrition, they go to grab the spoils of war, and they take this horse within their city gates. Of course, in the cover of night, the Greeks sail back. And the handful of soldiers who are inside the horse come out, open the gates, and the Greeks come and they fell the city. Right? Isn't that how it goes? Remember your epics. And of course, the metaphor of the Trojan horse has come to mean something to us. It's a symbol of that thing which we think is a spoil of war, we think is sort of a symbol of victory, which we take into ourselves and ends up being our undoing. It ends up being the thing that that ruins everything. So I want to make an argument this morning that we were convinced not so long ago that we could make church a spectacle. The church could be something that's essentially a stage and an audience. And that people would come. And that we could be culturally relevant. And that we could somehow enter into a place of cultural significance and transformation. That we could put on a good enough show to really bring people to Jesus and change the world. And we bought that. And we brought it into ourselves. And it has become our undoing. And let me tell you why. In 1964, a woman called Kitty Genovese, I think it was in New York City, was brutally stabbed and murdered in full view of her neighbors. 26 people watched on as she was knife to death. What's significant, and what I think there was a New York Times article that came out immediately after, what was significant about that was that all of these people neither said anything, didn't engage, and when the police asked what happened, they had nothing to say. Social psychologists would come to look at that one event and label it the phenomenon of, they would call the bystander effect or bystander syndrome. And one of the ideas that come out of that notion of the bystander effect is what they call the diffusion of responsibility. And diffusion of responsibility essentially says the more people that are watching something horrible or diabolical, the less each person feels responsible to engage in, to do anything about it. This is what happens to us, essentially. Now, what's interesting is if you were to contrast that with something like the story of the Samaritan on the road from Jericho that Jesus talked about, where there's just one person witnessing the death of another. And that would be the consolidation of responsibility. And when that happens, typically human beings feel they must do something. Do you understand? I'm the only one seeing this. I'm the only one bearing witness to this horror. I have to do something, because if I don't, no one will. Do you understand that dynamic? And in the diffusion of responsibility, or in the bystander effect, what happens is we just think, well, there's so many people watching, somebody else will do something. It's not really my fault. It's not my responsibility. What does this have to do with me? And so what we've done is we've taken this our ecclesiology, and we've essentially said that church is a thing you watch. It's a thing you spectate. And the more people we can get in the room, the better, actually. And so we just keep diffusing responsibility so that everyone begins to believe. I mean, at a profound psychological level, church is not something I'm responsible to do in the world. It's something people do on a stage. Even if I wanted to, even if I thought somehow I'm supposed to be the church in the world, I wouldn't know how. Because all that I've seen, all that I've been shown, is I need a stage and an audience. So actually, in order for this approach to work, I need people to be passive. They can't get up and do anything. They can't walk around. They can't talk. Actually, what we need you to do to make this expression of the church work, to make this model work, is to not feel responsible for the church at all. And maybe you've experienced this, I don't know, but sometimes church people complain. No? It never happened to you? So sometimes the audience, and then what they'll say to you is, you know, the church needs to do this. The church needs to take care of the homeless. The church needs to give more to this. The church needs to be doing something in the community this. Has anyone ever heard that? Mm-hmm. Because, and that's our fault. Do you understand? I want to take responsibility here. That's our fault. Because we have created this dynamic where we told them, we are the ones that do the church. You watch. You watch. You give money. And you do small sort of custodial tasks. Let the professionals do it. Of course, the irony of that is most of what we've tried to do from the stage is actually terrible and not enjoyable to watch or entertaining or anything like that. So that is our Trojan horse. That is our Trojan horse. We thought this would be the way. We thought this would be the answer. And at the end of the day, all we've done is diffuse responsibility so that there are real problems in the world which our people are actually equipped, called, prepared and eager to engage, but we've told them church is a thing you watch. It's a spectacle. It's a spectacle. So unraveling that or undoing that is something we have to face. I don't care how you do it. Do it, though. Find a way to do it. And of course, the irony for many of you, I know, because I'm more and more in conversations with leaders of conventional churches, traditional church forms, and they're just as frustrated with that dynamic. They want their people to engage. They want their people to be active in mission. They want their people to share their faith. They want their people to embody the kingdom of God outside the walls of the church. But we have to acknowledge and admit we're counter-mandating that. With the way that we present the church as something that you watch. So how do we get the church back into the hands of its people? How do we see a renaissance in the priesthood of all believers? That sort of foundational idea connected, at least for us, for those that are Protestant in the room. How do we do that? I mean, just a quick moment from my own personal story, because I was in the parachurch, which is a misnomer, by the way. I was in the parachurch, and so I essentially saw myself as a missionary. That's how I understood myself, my theology, everything I did, and everything about the way I understood the world or scripture was missiological. And I just put off ecclesiology. I just tabled it. Because I didn't want to do it, because I thought, if I start thinking about what the church is, I'm not going to be able to keep going to church. I knew that. Like, at a deep level, I knew. I just can't do it. Because I needed to be a part of local churches, and I needed to play that game, keep going. But I knew that if I ever did it, I would have real issues. And I actually think in our time, if I could push traditional church leaders in one way, I would say, don't be afraid to actually do the work of ecclesiology. Don't just accept your inherited system. Do it for yourself. Think for yourself. Ask yourself, if when I read the New Testament, and when I dream, and when I pray with hope, and when I encounter the presence of God, what do I see the church as? What is the church? Not what has the church been. And by the way, there's no need to put down a previous form. In fact, you could make the argument that the form in which I'm criticizing right now was useful and helpful in the milieu in which it occurred. There's no problem with that. The only relevant issue for us now is it now? Does it? I mean, just your own conscience. Does it reflect the deepest sense of what you believe the church is and can be? If you're honest about that and you say, okay, what do I really believe the church is? We call it, I mean, in our community and movement, we call this the ecclesial minimum. How do you
How do you break down the church to its irreducible minimum? That is to say, I think everyone should do that. Every single serious Christian leader who's engaging the church at any level should do that work of minimal ecclesiology. That is to say, if you strip this away, would it still be the church? For example, do you need a building to be the church? That's an easy one. So we're going to start with an easy one. Do you need a building to be the church?
No.
You don't. Buildings aren't bad. It's good to have a building in many cases. But do you need that definitionally to be the church? Yes or no?
No.
No. Do you need money to be the church? If this is already controversial, we're in trouble.
It's not a trick question.
You don't need money. It's good to have it. We sure could use some. It's better probably to have maybe than not. But so you do that. You keep stripping away. And then what are you left with? What are you left with? Now, what I wouldn't argue is to say, okay, that's the only thing the church should be. It can't be sophisticated. It can't be complex. No. In fact, I would argue there are people who are sort of interested in reductionism, just breaking down to something so that it can be multiplied, or this sort of orgy of you know, replication. Everybody wants to replicate, which is just, to me, it's just a new form of American egoism and empire. It's just like we've gone from I want to have a really big church to I want to have tons of churches. So it's just the same expression of sort of broken male, masculine ego mania is really what it is. It just keeps finding its way into our new forms, and it pollutes these ideas. Instead, I would say, can we break it down so that it can be simple enough so that it can be given back to the people? And then it can build complexity. I like the idea of things becoming more and more complex. They need to, depending on the context in which they're planted. So for us, and if you've read my book, you know, for us, the three things that we would boil down to is worship, that's like the lordship of Jesus, community, that is real Christians with real life on life stuff, and then mission. Expanding the boundaries of the kingdom somewhere, somehow. Evangelism, care for the poor, the light penetrating darkness, the kingdom breaking in to the demonic realm. That's mission. And so this space here is the church. The coalescence of those three. This is my opinion. You do it yourself. You do your own work of ecclesiology. And whatever you come up with, maybe it'll be 9 marks, maybe it'll be 6, maybe it'll be 14, I don't know. It's a bit much. But whatever your minimum is, boil it down to something which then could be given away to the people. Now, if your minimal ecclesiology said you have to have an MDiv, to have to have a leader, there has to be a building, there has to be ordination, there has to be all that stuff, well, then you're right back where you started. And I respect that. If that's really what you believe, if that's your high church ecclesiology, then by all means, plant those things. Plant them as quickly and as vitally as you can. But most of us, if we really do this work of reducing, would end up with something which is a little more usable. And actually, we'd think, well, a disciple, or a serious disciple, could lead this. So what we discovered is that there's more of these things out there than we realized, and they're not being called church. 180, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. Is a church, in my view. In this minimum ecclesiology, they meet that. Is Jesus Lord of 180? Is a real community? Do people really love each other and are in each other's lives and trying to see each other grow and develop? And is there an intention of like fighting back evil, bringing the kingdom of God into your city? Yes, that's a church. So it might not meet another definition of church, but for me it does. Now, once you do that, a lot of things suddenly are church. And then I think what we have is we have the need to then bring the goods of the kingdom, the sacramental life, into those things. The downside is we have things which we've called church, which actually aren't missional at all. So they wouldn't even meet my simple... There are things... In this city, if we drove around, we'd find places with signs out front that say church on them
and they wouldn't meet my basic definition. Because in some cases, that's all they are. It is a worship gathering. People don't really know each other, and there's no intention to penetrate darkness in the city. So just because you put a sign up front and you have some of these other trappings, in my view, doesn't make you the church. And in some cases, you have people in parachurch, which is parallel, engaging in the work of mission in the name of Jesus, for Jesus, in serious community with each other, but we told them they're not the church. And because of that, they are poorer for it, and we are poorer for it. We told them, go to church, get to church, be a part of a church. That's what we told them. And that's so disempowering, both to the things in your city which already exist, which already might even be part of your community, actually. And we have not given them the sacred things. And unfortunately, they have underperformed as the church because we told them they weren't. So they're not actually delivering discipleship, delivering the sacraments, delivering, I don't know, the goods of the kingdom in the way that they possibly could, because we robbed them of that core identity. We didn't ordain them. We didn't ask them to be elders. We didn't make them take seriously the work of biblical hermeneutics or biblical leadership or any of that stuff, because we said, well, that's nice. That's cute. You're a nonprofit. That's what you are. And the irony is, in some ways, in some cases, they are more positioned, better positioned to be the church, a transformative element somehow, to usher in the kingdom and the reign of God in our city, than our worship stuff is. We're all at a loss because of this problem of equivocation, this failure to properly define what is and what is not the church. Now, again, that's my ecclesiology. Yours might be different. Whatever it is, if you could break it down, figure out what it is for you, and then break it down so that it can be given away to the people of God again. And the truth is, the reality is, the church all over the world is actually small. It's small. Something like 60% of all churches in North America are less than 100 people, between 7 and 99 people. 60%. Did you know that? Did you know 95% of all churches in North America are less than 500 people? 95%. That, we call that statistically significant. So what that means is that right at 95%, you can start saying, this is the case. You no longer have to say percentages anymore. So what you then could say is that the church in North America is small. But the problem is, we have these anomalies, these statistical outliers, that are thousands of people. And they've poisoned us. Now, please don't hear me. They're lovely. And God is using them. It's great. If you have a mega church, good for you. You're not walking out because you have a mega church, are you? No, you're good. Okay, good. It's all about timing. It's all about the timing. When you go to the bathroom, think about it. But they're anomalies. So they're great. They're great, but they're anomalies. But the problem is, we believe that's possible, and maybe even good, and maybe even what God really wants. Thousands of people in one room, calling themselves by one name, branding themselves as one thing. But the truth is, if you just look back and you ask yourself phenomenologically, what is the church in North America? It is not that. It is something small. It's something small. And instead of feeling good about that, or trying to lead that, manage that, replicate that, give life to that, bring vitality to that, do that more and more, and do that really well, like, we're not asking the question, how do you lead 100 people beautifully and powerfully within a city? Because we think something's wrong with us when we have 100 people. We think we're broken. We think we're bad leaders. We think we failed somehow spiritually. Because look at them over there, they have thousands of people. As if that's better. And part of what I'm saying is, if you just look at, if you believe, do German Baptists believe in the sovereignty of God? Is that a thing that you believe in? It wasn't 100% ish, okay. So, if you believed in something like the sovereignty of God, the finger of God through history,
which is beyond our machinations and our strategies and all that stuff. And you just took a step back and you say, what did the church, if God is somehow involved in the working of the life of his church, you'd have to say he wants his church to be small. It's what he does. It's what he's doing. It allows it to be contextual. It allows it to be fluid. It allows it to be led by more people. It allows higher levels of participation. It allows higher levels of creativity. It allows money to be used in a better way. It requires less resources. I could go on and on and on. There's a beautiful, there's a couple times in where Jesus talks about little ones, and I love this. And in Greek, the word there is micron. If anyone, Jesus said, if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble. Do you remember what he said next? It's better for you to be dead. This is strong language. Can we agree? Jesus is very fired up about defending the integrity and the importance and the dignity of little ones, of microns. Little ones who believe in me. Now, he could have said child. That's our impression of the story. But he chooses not to, and I'm not sure why. Maybe so that today I could apply it in this way. Probably not, but maybe. There's something is expressed in that in the heart of God, which says, don't you dare talk about little ones in a way that makes them lose heart or lose faith. The word there, stumble, causes one of these little ones to stumble, is the Greek word scandalize. And this, my argument this morning, is a scandal. That we have said the church is big, when it's big, it's healthy and it's awesome. And when it's small, it's inept and impotent and weird. And I just think, how dare we do that? How dare we? Especially when you can actually make a case, right or wrong, you could at least make a case that that's a better version of the church. Let's stop scandalizing the small. And instead, let's make it even smaller. Let's make it even more accessible. Let's accept that as who we're maybe supposed to be. And then begin to give life and value and resources and I don't know. Let's reform so that those beautiful, small, powerful little expressions of the church are who we are and what we do. Let's stop trying to be this other thing, which we have just been beating our head against the wall trying to be anyway. And even if you could become that, you're an anomaly. You being the outlier is not helping the rest of us. It's really not helping the rest of us. Am I right? Am I not right about that?
Yes.
Is it not frustrating? Does anybody in here not have a church that's thousands and thousands of people? Does anyone have in that situation? It's like it can't. It hurts us. It damages us. It causes us to stumble when we only pursue this dream of a big, big, big church, of the super church that does everything. You want to say something? Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
This is so great to hear, and it's like, my heart's long, my soul's long to hear this. You know, I read the books, other webinars, this today, what you're saying right now, being in the room with you. Thanks.
Amen. Well, okay, so emotionally, that experience of feeling whatever's packed in there of years and years of going to seminars and conferences and oogling over the big impressive super church, and then that negative reflection that does, that self-evaluation, which says, I guess I'm just not any good at this. I'm saying, okay, look, I'm saying that that reality has been a problem all along. It's problematic. It's wrong. And again, I'm not. If you're gifted to lead thousands of people something, then run with it. Go for it. It's not for me to say that isn't okay or shouldn't be done. All I'm saying is it's an outlier. It's not. You can't say statistically that's what the church is. The church is something smaller, as if God wants that. And maybe he does occasionally want these sort of super things that let them do what they're going to do. Let them make their contribution in the world. Good. But that's not, most of us aren't going to do that. So let's stop trying. Let's stop pretending. And instead, let's take a step the other way. And let's actually not do to our people, to our parishioners, what that whole rat race has done to us. Let's actually go all the way back and say, actually, the church doesn't even need to be 100 people. You know, it could be 20 people. And it could be led by a layperson. And it could be even more fluid, even more contextual, even more creative, and cost even less money. And this is a part of what we've discovered, is that if you do this, if you revive the priesthood of all believers, if you remind people that they're called people, and have them ask God himself, not you, but God himself, what am I supposed to do in the world? Where am I supposed to express the church? And if I have even an ounce of leadership, and I have some passion for something, or I'm already placed somewhere in terms of opportunity, where the kingdom is needed, and I'm already there. So we're talking about, missiologically, we're talking about every single gap in your city, every single need, every single kind of person can be reached if we empower our people. Because God already knows and sees all those needs, all those cracks and crevices, all those missionary gaps, and he already has people in mind for all of those places. And what we need to do, and I'm not saying this as hyperbole, I'm saying this because this is actually what I think is happening. We have to step out of the way, move ourselves from the place of leadership where we deploy God's people and we let him deploy his people himself. And that's what I think it means to be the head of the church. The headship of Christ means we let the Spirit of God actually renew a sense of calling in people to say, well, this is where I am, this is who I am. Look, I have a child with disabilities, and because of that, my whole life is kids with disabilities. My whole life is families with disabilities. So you know what? I just wish the church existed there. And they'll come to you and they'll say, why doesn't the church do something in this area? And it's all broken. And the church doesn't do something in that area because you can't, because your resources are small, because you only have 150 people in your church. But the problem is you're still trying to be the 15,000 person church. So you're not going to really give control back to that person to say, well, maybe you're supposed to plant a church for families with kids with disabilities. That's your heart. You wake up every day thinking about it. You care deeply about it. You're positioned in such a way to be able to be relevant, to do something creative which actually works and fits them. The Spirit of God is in you. You're a serious disciple. Plant a church. Be the church there. And by the way, it doesn't need to be 1,000 people. It can be 20 people.
Can I ask real quick, and you can talk about this later? That idea of, okay, so now my special needs kids or my disability kids are here. How is that benefiting the rest of the church if we become back together?
So give me 3 minutes, okay. And then we'll go into the second kind of framework there. Exactly. That's good. So I think we have to revive calling. We have to coach the disciple at work in the field of mission to actually release people, empower people. I think the super church model has given us the wrong goal. It's giving us the wrong target to hit because then we've imagined growing, which healthy things grow. We should be growing. But we've imagined what growing means is getting bigger. Well, who told you that? Who whispered that lie in your ear? Seriously. John Maxwell, that guy. That's a kind of growth, a version of growth, numeric growth. You guys probably heard me talk about, but our sort of infatuation with Fred Taylor and scientific management and efficiency and metrics and all that stuff is kind of corrupted our view of growth, of the health of organic growth. The truth is some things show health and growth by adding numbers. That's true. Some, and that may be the case in your ministry or whatever you do. But some, it's more about penetration, or it's more about cultural impact, or it's more about voice, or it could be more about beauty. Just something is so amazing. I mean, the best restaurant in your city
It's not how many seats it has. Mm-hmm. That's not what makes it the best restaurant, is it? The one restaurant in your city that everyone needs to go to if they go there. You don't go there because, oh my God, you got to see how many tabletops they have there. It's incredible. The food sucks, but and the service is bad, but and it's really high priced. But look at this. Just look at the sea of tables. No, there's something about it which is beautiful, which is delicious, which represents the culture, the life, the history of the city. And if that restaurant disappeared, everyone would grieve. That's growth too, to grow in significance. And so it's not up to us to determine what necessarily even growth looks like. Someone had a hand up back there? No? Good. I like it. I think I just keep talking and I beat your questions down into the ground. Seeing the kingdom come is a different kind of growth too. So we might say the work we do is actually bringing growth to the kingdom, but not our little thing. And because we have so bought in to this siloed approach, which is branded and then attached to my own significance as a human being and as a leader, I need people to come under my brand to feel significant. And that really works against a deeper ethic of the kingdom of God. Because if I start doing the work of ministry and nobody really comes to my church thing, but they keep becoming disciples or they keep doing other things, I'm still seen as a failure. I see myself as a failure. Guys, that's so broken. We have to allow ourselves to grow and actually to believe that growth is important and to measure our leadership at some level in terms of growth, but to understand growth is this much more sophisticated, dynamic thing. Transformation, so on. I don't know if I talked with you about this before, but there's in marketing, there's the idea of a branded house or house of brands. A branded house would essentially be everything has to have the same name on it, the same brand. Starbucks might have their coffee, they might have their mugs, they might have their hats, everything has to have the same brand on it, you understand? But something like Beatrice or General Mills would be what's called a house of brands. And what they mean to do is to be a sort of shy brand. So you go get your Cocoa Puffs and your Pop-Tarts and you get your Pillsbury. Those are all brands, but actually up in the little corner it says General Mills. That's a house of brands. I would say the future of the church and this idea of microchurches is really more about creating a house of brands. That is to say, everything doesn't need to have First Baptist whatever name on it. But we thought that was the way to go. If there's going to be a ministry to homeless people, it needs to be First Baptist Church Ministry to Homeless People. It needs to be branded, and we need to control it and all of that. And if we break the church down into something much smaller, and in other words, we wanted a super brand. We wanted to create a church that was a super brand that did it all. That did it all. And by the way, you could argue, I'm not going to, you could say that power dynamic is dangerous for Christians. Because when you create a super kind of brand, you typically have a hierarchy that manages it, and you have one or two or a couple of people at the very top, and that ends up killing that person. They're not going to make it. They don't survive. And even if they survive morally, which is rare, they will not survive spiritually. Something will happen to their soul. I promise you. Be careful what you wish for. Be careful what you wish for. So again, I would say more, instead of like a massive super brand that does all the ministries, we need to learn how to network together, collaborate in mission, and mapping out our cities to try to see every kind of thing happen and all kinds of new creative ideas coming out, and to not necessarily need our brand or our name or our ego attached to those things. So we still need to be connected to something bigger. So this brings me to the second idea, the second form, which is the church as network. I know I'm running short on time here, so let me go faster. I've made this argument elsewhere. Maybe we could talk more about it if you want to. But I think the church is emerging as a network. Everything, actually, all forms of power and all forms of social enterprise are are nodal. They're essentially existing as networks. So again, this is happening whether you like it or not. This is the world in which we live. You can keep resisting it. You can pretend like somehow you're immune to it, but or you could walk into it. And again, I actually think this is a biblical possibility for us. There's a guy called Moises Naim who wrote sort of mind-bending book I read recently called The End of Power. He's a Venezuelan intellectual. I think he was the Minister of Industry or something like that in 1989 in Venezuela. So he's probably one of the top 50 intellectuals in the world in terms of economics. And he makes the argument, not just does he say that power is being redistributed. English. So redistributed. Still doesn't sound right. Redistributed. Black Germans. Not only that is happening, that there's what he actually calls micro powers. So power is being broken down and it's being distributed into smaller units, being dispersed into smaller units, which he calls micro powers. But what's really interesting about Naim's thesis is he's saying actually power is being destroyed. This is truly unique and actually does kind of ask certain questions. That is to say that there is less power available today than there was 100 years ago, 50 years ago, even 30 years ago. That this is what's happening. Power is being broken down, pressed down, and in some cases destroyed and redistributed in smaller doses. Now listen, I think that's great news. I think that's great news. Well, it's great news if you're ready for it. It's great news if you're still going for the sort of big massive ego and the singular leader, the great man myth, and the mystique in the smoke-filled room. If that's what you want to be, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. Instead, I think there's a lot of hope for the church as network. And if you look at all the research on emergence, what's called emergence, that is to say social networks, how they form, and then social networks becoming world influencers, like global influence that comes from organic social networking. It's all very fascinating. I read another book very recently. It's a new book by Hemans and Timms called New Power. And essentially their argument is that old power structures, old power systems, which consolidate power at the top, which are essentially hierarchical, are being replaced, so similar thesis, are being replaced by what they call new power systems, which are dispersed. Now, why is that significant biblically? Because the church was always meant to be diaspora. It was always meant to be scattered. The few times we've tried to keep it's such a small window of time in the early church in the book of Acts, but we have that one kind of event where the early church wanted to consolidate. They did not want to spread, or they did not want to follow the mandate of going into the world. And remember what happened? Persecution hit, right? It feels like, at least the way Luke tells the story in the book of Acts, it feels like the sovereign hand of God to say, I asked you guys to spread. I asked you guys to scatter, to be that my diaspora in the world, and I will bring power to you if you do that. I will deliver power to you if you will go in small units. I mean, understand, just a handful of people thinking, how are we going to reach the world? We have to keep breaking ourselves down into small units and trust and believe that a few of us plus the presence and power of God is enough. Is enough. And of course, the danger is if we consolidate human power, it's the Tower of Babel. It's the exact opposite of Pentecost. It's the belief that we can do this on our own, that if enough of us cooperate, we could do something awesome and we don't need God anymore. That's a serious threat. That's always been a serious threat to the life and work of the church. Is that what if we build something really awesome, then we don't need God? And what is Pentecost if not a reversal of the Tower of Babel? Right? Again, a scattering through language, essentially, which is the same thing that happens in Babel, to deliver the kingdom of God, the people of God, and the church, that delivery system being the church, into the world. I'll just give you one quick... but anyway, the dynamic from going from loose social networks to global power players. That's happening. That's happening in our time, all over the place. I mean, I'm in the middle of something like that in the underground. It's like a thing to behold. And somebody came up to me yesterday. I can't remember. They said, "Oh, I met somebody. They said they were part of the underground. We met them here and said they were part of the underground. Was that you? Yeah. Said they're part of the underground." But then I said, "Oh, do you know Brian Sanders? Because he knew we were going to see each other." And the guy's like, no, I don't know who that is. But it's the thing I'm a part of is like comes out of Tampa. And he goes, yeah, I think that's the same guy. He's like, no, it must be a different one because I never heard of this guy. That's really important. You see what I'm saying? That's really important. We have sister movements that are part of that are like covenanted with us. And one of them recently met me and goes, who are you? He literally said, who are you? You see how important that is? The decentering of sort of one person. And it is this kind of social network phenomenon. I'll give you one metaphor to explain this. Does anyone know what the two best-selling video games of all time are? You want to take a guess? None of those. The number one best-selling video game of all time is Tetris. The game Tetris. Remember that? Started by a Russian guy. That doesn't count as a video game.
You don't die.
How?
I never heard this definition. Okay. It's a dark definition, man. Tetris, the first iteration of Tetris came out in 1984. Tetris is an old power system. Tetris is solitary. You do it by yourself. I can remember spending hours and hours on my little Game Boy in the mid-80s, wasting hours playing Tetris by myself. It's top-down. It's coming at you. It's not flexible. You take what they give you, and you try to make something out of it. The goal is to actually get rid of the blocks for as long as you can, but you cannot win. You cannot win. You can only take longer to lose. Right? And this is the important thing. This is the important thing. You can only feel successful at the game in comparison or competition with someone else. It's about beating someone else's score or your own score. Tetris is old power. The second best-selling video game of all time, don't question my definitions anymore, is called Minecraft. Minecraft, I think, came out in 2011. What's interesting is my boys, I have two boys that still left at home. I have six kids, but my two youngest are still at home. And I'll see them. They live in Dublin, Ireland, and they will waste hours on Minecraft. Now, Minecraft is a world where nothing exists. It's a desert. And you have tools, and you can build anything you want. You can build anything you want. Not only that, so Minecraft is a new power expression. Minecraft is about creativity and it's about collaboration. You don't really play it alone. You play it with others. My two boys, what they do is they get on the Xbox, and then their two best friends from Tampa get on the Xbox. They wait until their schedules cross. And they all four get on at the same time and they build things together. They build worlds. Tetris always ends, you always lose. Minecraft never ends. It is all creativity. You can build any world you want, any way you want. That's new power. It's collaborative. It's creative. It's positive. It's social. These are new power systems. So back to the question about, you've got these small, contextualized, focused, missional things. But if they're on their own, if they're isolated, then isn't that somehow making the rest of the people of God diminished by them not being a part of it? This is why it's not just enough to say, let's empower microchurches, let's do like a house church movement, because those things have happened in history, and they last about 10 years. And they break down, and here's why they break down. They break down because of some kind of theological failure or moral failure. Somebody touches a kid, somebody sleeps with somebody, somebody steals some money, or somebody goes off the rails theologically. And it lasts about 10 years. These organic, completely decentralized things, they cease to exist after about 10 years because of human failure. So what we need to add to the microchurch idea form is this idea of networking, of centralizing the decentralized, of actually having an aspect. So this is good news for those of us that are in full-time ministry or clergy types. There's still a role for you. You're not obsolete. You just have to do something different. To lead a network is slightly different than to lead a traditional church. And part of what it is bringing together that strength. It's to actually have them be in relationship with each other. These smaller, autonomous, beautiful expressions of the church need to relate to each other. They need to bring their beauty to each other, and they need to also bring their emphasis so that you can see that actually you're a part of something bigger than just your own small thing. The last thing I'll say, the last kind of form that, and I heard Dan talk about it, is the idea of movement. Now here's the trick. You probably know the most about this, so I'm not gonna belabor this. But movements, I mean, if we think of it sequentially, you can think of microchurches become networks, networks network together with other networks and become movements. You become a part of something which is just beyond you. I mean, a primary element of movement is no one controls it. It cannot be controlled. No singular human being controls it. So the problem is, again, we've taken our sort of American, leadership lust, and we say, well, I want to lead a movement then. Well, that's the next big thing. I want to lead a movement. But here's the bad news. Movements cannot be led that way. It is anathema to movement itself. Movements are not achieved. They're not engineered. They're not laid hold of by great leaders. If you want to lead a movement, you probably shouldn't. You probably won't. Movements require a certain kind of leader, a new form of leadership. It's more about being a part of the sovereign hand of God. I don't know if any of you lived through the Jesus movement in the 60s, Who led that, It's a trick question. Nobody led the hippies, Jesus led the hippies, But what came out of that, Calvary Chapel, Vineyard, there are expressions of the Jesus movement that became, that formed into things which were essentially like living networks, possibly became institutionalized and now are less meaningful than they were. I almost said meaningless. It's terrible. All right, last thing I'll say. Are you familiar with the term disruption?
In terms of organizational systems and stuff like that? Call it creative disruption. There's
always things that happen in technology which disrupt existing models. And the underground is a kind of disruption. This conversation is a disruption for your life. I was just thinking about this morning. When I think about the dynamics of disruption, in the church, in the kingdom. So sometimes disruption happens because it's external, it's cultural. And sometimes disruption happens, it's God, actually. See, we can say that. We can look at it and say, God, is this you? Are you disrupting us? Because we've lost our way. Because there's mission drift, or because our values have slipped. And when I think about, in the course of history in the church, the history of the church, and I think about these disruptions that happen that bring us back to something, it's always about mission. It's like, I was just thinking of it in terms of stable and unstable equilibriums.
So this is a stable equilibrium, right? So if I drop a ball in here, it's always going to want to come back to here. But if I put a ball here and balance it there, that's what's called a unstable equilibrium. It sits there, but man, just a little nudge this way, or a little nudge that way, and it's off, right? This is mission. This is outward focus. Outward, the outward work of the church, to care about people that are not there,
who are lost or poor or broken or depressed or suicidal, just outside of the walls of the place where you work and minister.
That is an unstable equilibrium. Very hard to balance that, to keep that in focus. And very easy to drop off. But this inward point, this idea of like, let's take care of ourselves. Let's look after the people who are here. Let's make sure that they're satisfied, that they're okay, because their needs are always coming back to us. That is a stable equilibrium. And the church is always threatened by this sort of return to, let's just care about ourselves. Let's focus on ourselves. Let's deal with ourselves. These are our problems we have to look at. And the only way the church ever kind of comes back into the place of mission is some sort of disruption. Francis of Assisi, Benedict, Ignatius, Teresa, Martin Luther King, John Wesley, Luther. It's as if to say the church has forgotten itself because it's forgotten the people that aren't there. It's forgotten what it's meant to do in the world. I have 6 kids. One of them is very wayward. She's an addict. The things that she's experienced and gone through is just... She's 20 years old. Her body is... There's not a 6-inch piece of her body which is not scarred. She's cut herself from literally from neck to the soles of her feet. And there's been times where she just disappears. We don't know where she is. And it's a kind of pain. Many of you are parents, you know. It cannot be put into words. It's completely debilitating in every way. And not long ago, when she was sort of in the wind, we didn't know where she was, some friends of ours were driving and they saw a young woman on the side of the road crying, heaving, you know, like in a pile, just weeping on the side of the road, just in the middle of the urban setting, you know. And they looked closely, 2 very good friends of mine, they looked close and they saw it was Eve. Now I'm going to ask you, the question, like really think about the question. If they don't stop, are they my friend? Can they really say, we love Brian, if they don't stop? When they see my daughter in that condition by the side of the road, is that possible to believe that such a relationship exists between us, which is love or affection or respect or admiration or anything positive, and they keep driving? Is that possible? No. You say you have faith, James said. Good. Show me. Show me. Of course, they did stop. They put their arms around her. They said, you know, Eve, what's going on? They tried to comfort her. Can we help you? Of course, she didn't want help. This is part of, you know, addiction. But they text me. This is happening.
And I felt in that moment, I feel the power of the diaspora, of the hands of God in the world. And in that sense, we're everywhere. And I'm comforted by that. There's nowhere my daughter can go where his people are not there. But if they don't understand themselves to be agents of his kingdom, they'll miss that possibility, that opportunity. And if we have told them that the church is just simply this thing they come to and give money to and watch and admire spiritual people that are on a stage, then in those moments they will drive by these daughters and sons who belong to the heart of God. And all this stuff isn't just theory for me. Please understand. If we had more time to really know each other, and maybe some of that will happen today, but if you really could know me, you know that actually what drives all of this theory and strategy and considering what the church could become is a deep brokenness and what Soren Kierkegaard, unreconciliation with the world. I feel like the world isn't right, and I see all of this pain and all of this suffering, and I just think surely we have to be doing more, being more somehow. Well, let's accept responsibility for the brokenness of the world. We don't blame darkness when there's darkness. We are the light. This isn't just about making your church cooler or better or work better or have more people come or whatever, some new strategy or whatever. It's about Eve. It's about my daughter. And maybe she'll find her way in your town or somebody else's daughter or your daughter. And will the church be alive there? Will it be activated? Will it be empowered? Will it believe itself to be the one that's supposed to wrap its arms around the broken? And will it say, does it think it's possible to say, I love Jesus, I love God, and I have no interest in seeing his kingdom come to people that don't have it? I don't do anything. I don't engage anywhere or anyone. We have to eliminate that as a possibility in the decades to come. We have to recapture the centrality of mission. This is in the end how movement will happen. It won't happen because it is happening, and you can be a part of it or not. This is what the church is becoming, because it's what God wills, I think, for it to become. To return again to that call to mission to people. That's probably enough.